Welcome to today's MediNews podcast. Today, Mark Campbell and I, Desmond Fernandez, take great pleasure in welcoming two delegates from the Defend Kurdistan Initiative, which is currently on a visit in Iraqi Kurdistan. The Defend Kurdistan Initiative is an international delegation for peace consisting of journalists, feminists, politicians, academics, ecologists, and members from anti-war groups from various European countries, including Germany, France, Italy, Denmark, and Switzerland. Some members of the delegation arrived in Erbil in Iraqi Kurdistan last week. Whilst 14 members of the delegation were deported from Iraqi Kurdistan, other peace activists were controversially prevented from leaving Germany to get to Erbil. 27 members of the delegation who went to Germany's Dusseldorf airport on the morning of the 12th of June, for example, were detained by the police and had their passports confiscated. The delegates were questioned by the police at the airport. German police reportedly issued a statement that the visit harms our relations with Turkey, which is a NATO partner. Despite these obstacles, some members of the delegation reached Iraqi Kurdistan to start the initiative against the military operations taking place by Turkey's armed forces in the region. Those military operations began on the 23rd of April this year. Announcing the establishment of the Defend Kurdistan Initiative, consisting of 150 peace activists, the delegates have, during their time there, visited several key affected regions and spoken to local villagers and representatives of non-governmental organizations and several key people to try and halt the conflict. The initiative has reported on the nature of Turkey's military incursion, stating, and I quote, "These genocidal acts from Turkey are continuing right now, using military technology from Europe, whilst the government from Kurdistan remains silent," end quote. The initiative has also appealed to people everywhere to condemn the Turkish military attacks and to stop their governments selling weapons to Turkey. Stated, "We're really very pleased to speak to two delegates from the initiative today. Welcome. And could you please take us through the nature of the initiative, the difficulties delegates have had trying to get to Erbil, and the difficulties you have experienced in trying to proceed with your initiatives in Iraqi Kurdistan? What are your findings and the recommendations and messages you'd like to pass on regarding what you have seen and experienced? And once again, thank you so much for joining us on this program."
Yeah, hi, thanks very much for hosting us. We really appreciate it. And thanks for that great introduction. So the delegation came about to begin with a call out from the Kurdish movement. And this call out was sent out in Europe to friends and supporting organizations, people who've been organizing in Kurdish solidarity for some time. And through that, as you mentioned, 150 of us answered the call to try and come together and meet in Erbil in Iraqi Kurdistan. Unfortunately, not all 150 of us made it. As you said, there have been some, we faced some oppression in Dusseldorf, as you mentioned. And then there were some other activists in Catalonia, I believe it was, who were prevented from boarding their flights as well. And of the rest, there were at least another 40 deported from upon arrival from Erbil airport back to their countries of origin. It may be more, but at least I know it was at least 40. And so unfortunately that meant that our delegation was down to about 70 people actually able to meet in Erbil. And many of the people we've spoken to since we arrived, many of the Kurdish people have been very apologetic on behalf of the Kurdistan regional government. And they've been telling us this is not the Kurdish way. Kurdish people are usually extremely hospitable and they're very disappointed in their government for treating these international delegates who are here to campaign for peace after all in such a harsh way. So that was the arrival in the beginning.
Yeah, that was in the end of the problems, actually. Once we were able to make it to Erbil, we were basically prevented from doing anything. All our meetings were cancelled. The people we were supposed to meet with were threatened in order for them not to not to meet us. The worst thing was we were supposed to have this press conference in front of the United Nations headquarters in Erbil, and the night before the event, the government called us saying that we were not allowed to hold our press conference. In the morning, we woke up to the hotel being completely surrounded by not only militaries but SWAT teams, fully armed, like a crowd of them, who basically locked us in the hotel. They didn't allow us to go out. They didn't allow us to attend our press conference in front of the United Nations. So we held our press conference in the hotel lobby. Many journalists attended. Many interviews were released. Right after the interviews and the press conference, we decided to walk out of the hotel as a sign of pacific protest in order to reach the United Nations. But the military basically physically stopped us and pushed us and stuff like that. So in order to continue our pacific protest, we decided to perform an act of civil disobedience and sat down on right outside of the hotel. Sadly, even this act was stopped. We were only able to stay there something like 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes.
10 minutes,
I say. Chanting some slogans, basically asking for peace in Kurdistan and for union for the different Kurdish organizations. After 10 minutes, the police another time again forced us physically into the hotel. So in order to continue our disobedience, we started dancing, traditional Kurdish dances. We wanted to show resistance and pacific protest. And even this dance was stopped. So we were basically prevented from doing anything. And the following days, it got worse and worse. Like, we literally were locked in our hotel. Some people were able to come in. Some parliamentarians or intellectuals, we were able to meet some people, but always constantly in the hotel lobby. So we were not able to go out.
Yeah, we got pretty sick of that hotel lobby.
Yeah, totally.
and one thing that's just worth adding, like this presence outside the hotel, of course, didn't go away, and there was some pretty uncomfortable moments in the following days after the press conference. It's one thing to have, guys in military uniforms with fully automatic weapons sitting outside your front door, but it's another thing to have them like sharing your canteen, striding in and out of the lobby all the time whilst you're trying to have interviews with people who are presumably afraid of, of repercussions from the government. And then
so it's a direct act of intimidation there, really, isn't it? It's
absolutely
full intimidation there. All the time.
And even on a personal level for us, there were times when very late at night I was sitting uploading some texts or reports from the day, and I heard the radio crackle outside, right outside my hotel door, from some of the Peshmerga like strolling through the hotel, and somebody else actually had them come into their hotel room in the middle of the night. So
it was pretty intense.
Yeah, it's pretty uncomfortable to say the least. So after this, and after being constrained to only being able to talk to people who had, I suppose, the privilege or the status to be able to come publicly to our hotel lobby, and of course being unable to speak to any of the other people we wanted to from civil society organizations or whatnot, we decided that we'd sort of done what we could in Erbil, and it was maybe time to move on and meet some other people in other parts of Kurdistan. So then we got them. We took a bus to Süleymaniye, which is where we are right now.
Mm-hmm.
And interesting thing about Kurdish politics in the region is you have the KDP, which is the main ruling party in the government. It rules in a coalition, but it's the main party. And they have control of Erbil in terms of local politics. And then there's the PUK, the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, sorry, I should also say KDP is the Kurdistan Democratic Party and the PUK is Patriotic Union of Kurdistan. And the PUK have a majority in Sulaymaniyah, so they control this region. And so once we, the KDP followed us from our hotel all the way to the final checkpoint where control changes from the KDP to the PUK. And after that, their cars left us and went back to Erbil, and then we were able to continue freely to Sulaymaniyah on the other side of that checkpoint. And since we've been, since we arrived in this city, we've had, it's been somewhat easier to meet people, to go out and meet politicians, activists, intellectuals, civil society organizations. But I don't want to make it out like it's a utopia here either. It's still, we still had some problems. We had a press conference the morning we arrived here. And the plan was to have that in the hotel. We set up a space in the canteen. Journalists all arrived, and then at the last minute we had to get out and do it on the street, because the it turned out we were just not welcome. We were just not welcome to do the press conference in our hotel, and I would speculate that that's because of pressure or at least intimidation.
It was right at the very last minute, I seem to remember.
Yeah, exactly.
Everything was set.
Yeah.
So we just all ran out onto the street, basically, and found a bit of wall with enough space on the pavement. Yeah. And then set it up there and did it last minute in the 40-degree heat. But which is not ideal, but we got the message out.
So then I'm actually losing track of days. That was that 2 days ago?
More than that.
Oh gosh. Yesterday I think you went to visit the family of a Kurdish family that were victims of a drone strike 1 year ago.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. So could maybe if you could tell us about that. How was that experience?
That was intense.
Yeah.
That was heavy. It was we'd had an interview with somebody here in the hotel, who's part of the freedom movement based here in Sulaymaniyah and organizing like specifically around women's issues. And she told us of this family, and she said you really ought to go and visit these people to see like with your own eyes like the effects of the Turkish strikes and the invasion. This was from June 2020. And we drove out there and once again reached a point on the road and suddenly the bus pulls over and you look out the window and there's the guys in the camouflage uniforms again. And then, and then there's a lot of back and forth and we weren't sure whether or not they'd allow us to go past and to continue or not. Eventually we did. We pulled up and we went up to this house and we met this family there. And I think the first thing I'd say is, I'm genuinely amazed by their bravery and how much dignity they showed given the horrific injustice that they've survived a year ago. But essentially what happened was this family of civilians and they were hit by a Turkish drone strike. And the mother of the family lost her left leg. So she now walks with a prosthetic leg and has big scars up her forearms that she showed us, and her husband, he told us that he has bone fragments that were shattered and are still sort of lodged in his chest, which you can't just be pulled out. Of course, it takes like serious medical operation to extract those bone shards in a safe way that doesn't endanger his life, and it's very difficult, if not impossible, for him to get that treatment here. This is very emotional for us, like sitting there hearing the story, and there are a lot of Germans on the delegation as well. And so for us from the UK and from Germany to sit in that room and be like, yeah, this is our governments that are selling these weapons to Turkey that have done this to you. That's a really hard thing to look someone in the eyes and say. So we shared our analysis with them, and we talked about Yeah, the situation in the UK and Germany, and how, of course, we condemn our governments and selling these weapons to Turkey, and the arms trade in general that makes profit off selling tools of death to authoritarian regimes. Yeah.
That must have been quite...
I just remembered how that day ended.
I was just going to say when you left that family.
We were doing one last interview with her, recording it before we left, and suddenly the door bursts open and one of the others comes in and is saying, "Hey, the police downstairs, like, we got to go right now." And he was, you know, grabbing the cameras, and it was from the local Kurdish media. And so he was grabbing his cameras and hiding them away because he was saying the police are downstairs, like, we really need to go right now. So unfortunately we had to leave his family in a hurry, which was pretty heartbreaking. You know, when you open up a topic like that and someone opens up to you and shares these really heavy experiences with you, to then just like up and leave. I felt really, really bad for the family. I felt so sorry that we had to do that. Yeah, that's how it is when the authorities have decided that, all right, you've done enough and they don't want this story getting out, then that's it.
So then when you left that family and you were on the road, you got news of?
Yeah, of another airstrike.
I mean, that was quite, that must have hit.
We left at about 6:30 p.m., something like that, 6:40, for the drive back to Süleymaniye. And at 7 p.m., there was another Turkish drone strike, approximately 20 kilometers, I think.
Yeah, from 20 kilometers, the village of Galala.
From where we've been.
Which is very close to Süleymaniye, it's like right outside
Süleymaniye. Yeah.
So there was another strike there. We've seen some footage from there, and we heard that there were at least two people killed. Yeah. At least one was severely injured.
And how did that make you feel, having just spoken to a family who had gone through exactly the same thing? What were your feelings when you heard that?
I think it was a bit of despair. At least initially, I have to say, because you hear this story and we visited with the first family, you know, we visited the place, the corner store, which had to be completely rebuilt after the strike. And you can see on the side of the road where the missile hit. And there's a big sort of cascade of rubble down into the riverbed next to the road. You can see all these shards of shrapnel that have burst holes through the roadside and through the masonry work on the bridge. And that's 1 year old, and it's, you know, you can see the effects, but it's and obviously on the family, the effects on their lives and how much it's made life difficult for them since. But it's still a year ago. It's somehow there's still some distance, and you feel like it was amazing. As I mentioned, you know, seeing their dignity was incredibly impressive, and the fact that they still wanted to, that they want to talk to us and they want to contribute to this campaign. And they want us to get this message out there that this is what Turkey's doing. And us feeling some positivity from that, I suppose, in the sense that, like, we're doing what we came to do. You know, we're hearing people's stories and we're taking that and we're trying to spread the word about these atrocities. And then immediately to just hear that, like, here's another one yet again. And it almost felt like now we just have to kind of start all over again. Yeah, it's heartbreaking. I mean, these are civilians, you know, like in the video that one of the locals posted on Twitter, you could, like, it was a this house that was burning up after the strike. And this is, yeah, a small village in the mountains. It's people with no access to electricity or water, but, like, they just want basic human rights, you know. they're not asking for much, just like to not be bombed, to not be killed for the crime of being Kurdish.
And these drone strikes are quite regular, presumably. I mean,
yeah, they definitely are regular and constant, depending on the areas.
Yeah. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that, Jay?
Well, let's say that with the excuse of the PKK being in Bashur territory, Turkey is, I mean, Turkey keeps on doing airstrikes and bombing both the region of Kandil, where the PKK is supposed to be, but also civilian regions. Like, I mean, Galala is a very small village outside Sulaymaniyah. There is no PKK, there is just civilians living in the small houses. The heartbreaking and also interesting part is how they are using this tool of putting Kurds against Kurds, you know, like, people against people, in order to bring on their invasion. And the even worse thing is that this Turkish rhetoric is basically used by the KRG, which is the Kurdish regional government, the coalition we were talking about before. So that's really heartbreaking. You know, it's not just Turkey that is supporting this anti-Kurds campaign and this PKK excuse, but it's also the regional government of Iraqi Kurdistan, which is basically allowing Turkey to kill its own people.
I was going to say that I was on a delegation in 1993 in the emergency region of southeast Turkey when Turkish army were carrying out a sort of ethnic cleansing campaign against Kurdish villages in that area. And I mean, and from the way some of the aspects of what you have described to me about the way that the Kurdish police and the Kurdish army were behaving towards you was very similar to the way that the Turkish army were behaving towards us when we were investigating these allegations of human rights abuses against the Kurds as well, which I think that's quite shocking. And I mean, more generally, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of Kurds who find this very, very shocking. You know, the fact that Kurdish authorities are acting so closely with the Turkish army. What have you picked up in terms of the local Kurdish population and their thoughts about the KDP's complicity with the Turkish invasion and Turkish attacks?
I can say that all the people we have spoken with, both civil society, parties, representatives of some organizations, were against the KRG policy of putting Kurds against Kurds, all of them. It's incredible. Like, all these different parties with very different perspectives, they all agreed on this one point. Like, putting Kurds against Kurds is crazy. It's going to bring us to destruction. So I would say this is a very common feeling. Many people are absolutely scared and worried about this rhetoric, this Turkish rhetoric that the KRG is using. We absolutely share their fear. This is going to be a huge problem for the Kurdish cause and in general for the Kurdish people.
Yeah.
Like, if even the Kurdish regional authorities allow Turkey not only to invade, but to bring on a planned ethnic cleanse without saying a single word, that's terrifying.
So turning to you, over the last sort of 24 hours, we've been hearing rumors that the KDP are actually maneuvering into positions to actually take part in military operations with the Turkish army. So presumably that was the reason that you decided to go to Kandil today. Could you tell us a little bit about what happened today and your experience at the border with the Asayesh, at the Asayesh checkpoint, trying to get through to the Kandil area?
Yeah, I mean, we did try. We were able to pass, I believe, 3 checkpoints.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, it wasn't easy, but in the end, we were able to make it. There were, of course, lots of questions and lots of problems, but somehow, you know, we managed to get through. The problem was at the last checkpoint, the one right before Kandil. There were many people there actually waiting. They had been stopped as well. And the authorities just basically told us to stop. They were quite friendly, to be honest. When we went to speak with them, they were like, yeah, I mean, you're very welcome. We are very happy that you're here. We totally support your message of peace and freedom. You're so welcome, but we need to wait for a call. By our responsible, our commander or something. So please just be patient and wait. So we waited for a bit, then we saw that, you know, people were starting to be impatient. So we asked again, like, okay, did you receive this call? Like, what are we going to do? And once again, they were like, no, I mean, we have to wait, please wait, please wait. So we went outside to tell our group and other people what was going on. And a pacific protest started. People started marching towards the end of the checkpoint, claiming that they cannot just stop you like that. That's absolutely insane. And one person ended up being shot. Luckily, this person, this young man, was only slightly injured, but still, the pacific protesters were shot. And of course the protest immediately ended. And after that, we got the response that nobody was allowed to pass the checkpoint. So we had to, like, very quickly grab our stuff, like jump on our bus and go back. So this is it. I mean, another intimidation, another threat, this time very, very dangerous one. I mean, people could have been killed in this one. And yet again, they don't want people to see the truth. Basically, that's it. They are trying all the possible ways to sabotage our delegations and other delegations for people not to see the truth. Because there is clearly something that they are hiding. There is clearly something wrong with the rhetoric that all this invasion is happening because of PKK existing. That is absolutely not true. They are committing and supporting crimes against humanity, crimes against civilians, horrible crimes. And they don't want people to know. They're trying to hide it in all the possible ways. And this is why we have been stopped today. This is why we have been stopped a couple of days ago while we were trying to go to Mahmur camp. And the same reason why we were stopped trying to go to Shengal to see the Yazidi population. This is exactly the same pattern repeating over and over again. They're trying to prevent us from seeing the truth and spreading it.
It's extremely
worrying.
Yeah. And I was just going to say, this obviously has the international context as well. Obviously, German police issuing the statement that the visit harms our relations with Turkey, which is a NATO partner. You can obviously see some form of collaboration within the whole wider context of what's happening. Yeah. I know some members of the delegation also witnessed or attempted to record the type of environmental destruction taking place, which is also quite systematic. You know, there've been reports of trees being cut en masse and basically shipped and transported back to Turkey, where some people suggest that Turkish intelligence are behind that. But effectively, we're looking at massive deforestation taking place in these areas, with this massive intimidation of the military, and under the cover of this invasion has said this is happening on a massive scale. Were any of your delegates or yourselves able to get any further information about this?
From what I heard from some people we've been in contact with here, the numbers were as much as 300 and around between 300 and 400 tons of wood per day being deforested. Yeah, and there are photos circulating, actually you can find this online, the photos circulating of trucks just loaded to the top driving off to Turkey, basically, like literally just stealing the trees from Kurdistan and going back to sell it for a profit on the home side of the Turkey.
And as I said, people have even linked this to similar strategies in Afrin, obviously in Syria, where they've just been loading
with the olives
out there. It seems to be a systematic thing, which is obviously a terrible war strategy.
The public sort of excuse that you'll hear from Turkey is that this is our army engineers and this is absolutely necessary for us to chop down some trees so we can build roads, because it's a very inaccessible region. So we need to build roads from Turkey into Iraq so that our military can get in there and kill these terrorists. Right, that's the Turkish narrative. But what that actually looks like on the ground is you've stripped bare entire hillsides of all of their trees. Of course, it goes without saying, which destroys broad scale habitats. There are several endangered and even some endemic species to the region, whose habitats are just being destroyed by the hectare every day for the last few weeks. And this is, as I said, this is partly to just the cynical profit-making of selling Kurdistan's nature to make some money in Turkey. But it's also to make sure...
Yeah, and it also seems to be a very specific...
I was just going to say, if people don't have... If there are no trees, if there's no nature there, then people living the rural lifestyle up in the villages and the mountains, then they have no means of subsistence anymore. So this is part of a broader strategy of ethnic cleansing, and it absolutely constitutes a war crime.
Yeah, we're having a few technical overlaps here, I think. So yes, that was so. Yes, Des, that's on the environmental thing. So I was just saying the extraordinary scale of what's happening, of the Turkish army. I mean, it's unprecedented, and even the sort of the 40 years of the war that's been going on between the PKK and the Turkish state is completely unprecedented. And all the things that you have detailed here tonight, how do you feel that this is not being reported on our sort of headline news every night? I mean, what's your feelings about that?
I mean, of course, it feels awful. It feels incredibly frustrating. It feels like a massive injustice. It makes me really, really angry to be here and to see this destruction and this injustice and this, frankly, the beginning of genocide, of ethnic cleansing, this invasion. And to see all of this going on and there's nothing. There's really nothing in the media back home, which is, incredibly disappointing. But I think there are a lot of things that on the surface here seem very surprising. But when we dig into it, and the more we've learned over our time here in the last couple of weeks or however long it's been now, the more you sort of start to understand the deeper dynamics that are going on here. To go back to what we were saying about the beginning, arriving in Erbil under the banner of a delegation for peace and freedom in Kurdistan that is against the Turkish invasion of Kurdistan, and to be arrested and oppressed by the Kurdistan government for protesting against invasion into Kurdistan. This is a very, very strange scenario. Yeah, exactly. Very strange paradox. Yeah. But when you dig into it, then it begins to make sense, because what you have is a very small minority in the Kurdistan regional government who have effectively been forced by Turkey to make deals for their own financial benefit. And let's be clear, Turkey leaves no choice in agreeing to this, but they will get a financial benefit from this in return for saying and doing nothing to stop the Turkish invasion of their land. And then they have little choice but to go along with this Turkish narrative of terrorists, because otherwise there's no way they could publicly justify doing nothing on the issue. But if you take a step back, it's not as complicated as it all sounds. Middle Eastern politics is notoriously difficult to wrap your head around when you're not used to all these acronyms and parties and you haven't read a lot about the history of the region. But actually, it's quite simple what's going on here. We have people who are from Turkey, who originally from the state of Turkey, who experienced extreme oppression over the last 40 years from the Turkish state, to the point where in the 1990s they moved, a group of them, to Kurdistan of Iraq, to Bashur, and established themselves in the mountains, where they haven't been bothering the Kurdistan regional government. They've mostly been keeping to themselves. There's this sort of peace, basically, between the Kurdistan regional government and the PKK, who are based in the mountains. And that's it. It's essentially refugees from Turkey who are just taking refuge in the mountains, having been driven out of their home country. And now that country is coming after them, invading the sovereignty of another state to continue its genocide against them. And, you know, if we imagine, if we go back to Saddam Hussein, right, there were many Kurds fleeing Iraq during the Anfal campaigns here, which were horrific and left thousands and thousands of people dead. But if we imagine, you know, people are going to Iran, to Turkey, to Europe, throughout Europe, like Western Europe, the UK, especially Germany, especially Scandinavia. If Saddam Hussein had invaded the sovereignty of another nation to go after these people, these refugees who'd fled the attacks that he was making against their population, surely there would have been international outrage. There would have been a massive outcry about it, right? It just would have been impossible to imagine letting Saddam Hussein do that. So why on earth are we allowing Erdogan to do this? This is exactly what he's doing.
That's pretty simple too.
Yeah, exactly. And that's another one of these questions that is like simple. On the surface is this strange paradox. But
That's it. I mean, it's as simple as that. NATO will allow Turkey to do whatever it wants and wishes in order to have a powerful ally in the Middle East. So all the ecocide and genocide and all what they're doing, just so NATO can have a powerful ally in the Middle East, basically against, you know, Russia and China. That's it. All this pain, all this desperation for that, for international interests. This is more than heartbreaking. This, I mean,
I know. I mean, Des, sorry. Yeah.
A quick thing I was only going to say, and again, they try to stop you from going to Schengen, where obviously there's a similar thing where there's an agreement there, you know, between the KRG and obviously various other governments to try and move out the self-defense forces of the Yazidis who, you know, have suffered the worst, most horrific kinds of genocide under obviously ISIS. And I think there's a similar thing there, isn't there, of local people, there's this attempt to remove their rights to try and govern themselves.
So you broke up for a second there, but I think I caught what you said. these efforts to stop these efforts of people governing themselves, basically.
Yeah, I'm really sorry to our listeners who we're obviously having. You know, the odd technical communication issues. Both of you, we could round up just like 2 days ago when that airstrike hit that village, normally I would have expected the UK consular in Erbil to have condemned a missile strike against civilians in the country that he is in, but we didn't hear anything from the British representative in KRG. Perhaps we could end by both of you giving a message to your own governments about what you think our governments should be saying to Turkey right now.
The most important thing to do right now is to immediately stop selling weapons to Turkey. These weapons are being used to commit a horrible genocide against Kurdish people. You must immediately stop selling Turkey weapons. It's a dangerous country, it's a regime, it's a dictatorship, and these weapons are constantly used against civilians with the excuse of hitting terrorists. This is my first request that will be an immediate necessity.
Yeah. And also just to put pressure on Erdogan, to stop with the weapons he already has, to call off the entire invasion, you know, because historically when we see, you know, the rise of dictators, they become more and more confident the more powerful they get, right? And back in the day, before he was where he is now. Erdogan was coming on meetings to Baghdad and meeting Kurdish politicians there and was telling them, you know, oh, my great grandfather was a Kurd and all this sort of stuff. Very friendly. Yeah. And then somehow we got to where we are today. And I think this is only possible when governments like ours fail to call out regimes that are committing atrocities. Like, we have to take a stand as an international community and show this is not acceptable. You cannot do this, no matter what your role is in the geopolitical games. Like, this is a red line, and like, no, like, oppression of minorities or genocide or invasion or ecocide should be allowed to continue by tacit agreement in the silence that we're getting from our current governments. This is just absolutely unacceptable. And if we continue to stay silent, if you, our governments, continue to stay silent on this issue, then this is only going to get worse. And even from like a purely selfish, the Western security point of view, this strategy makes no sense of staying silent. You know, sure, we get a partner in the Middle East in the form of Turkey who's willing to cooperate with the US and Europe militarily. But we all know that Turkey was assisting Daesh in its efforts in Syria, right? And there's evidence right now that they're training jihadists, taking Syrian jihadists, people, militants who've been fighting in the Syrian war, training them in camps in Syria, in Turkey, and shipping them here to Bashur to fight the PKK in the mountains. There are so many training camps in Turkey right now where militants are being trained up by the Turkish army for its own nefarious ends. So, you know, this whole Western narrative about like, oh, well, you know, we need a stable partner in the Middle East, NATO, we're against terrorism. Your partner in the Middle East is the person who's training the terrorists. It is the terrorist, you know, that's the situation. So when we're talking about like stability in Europe and not wanting another Syria, you know, because of even from, like I said, even from a selfish perspective that our governments would take in terms of wanting stability and not wanting like another influx of refugees like we had from 2015 onwards. Yeah, like setting aside all the problems with that narrative, like even from that perspective, it still makes no sense because you're just fueling more conflict in the region. And we've been told by people we've met here that even on the regional local TV, like from Tunisia to Egypt to Iran to Syria, Baghdad, Iraq, like nobody wants this. Like none of the opinion in the region is in favor of Turkey's expansionism, of Turkey's invasion of Iraq, because they know it's destabilizing, and they know what a scary force Turkey is, with all its training jihadists who are, let's be honest, they're not going to be a controllable, disciplined military force in any sense. And
all the requests we should do to our governments and in the international community in general, removing the PKK from the terrorist list. PKK is not a terrorist group. PKK is a party. It's a party made of people resisting to invasion and genocide. And whether you agree or not with their political views, they are not terrorists. All this while Turkey is, by the way, training terrorists, like real terrorists. The second request is for our governments to stop criminalizing us internationalists. In many European countries and also in other countries, internationalists coming back from Syria, coming back from Rojava, coming back from fighting against Turkey and against Daesh, they've been criminalized. In Italy, one former YPJ fighter is now under basically arrest. She's under surveillance for 2 years for fighting ISIS. This is absolutely insane. We cannot accept this. We are a country, we are under a coalition of countries supporting Turkey, which is paying and forming jihadists, and all at the same time, our light is gone, and all at the same time, we are criminalizing our militants and our activists for peace. This is crazy.
It is really extraordinary. And So we have nobody speaking out about this. None of our governments are speaking out about it. We have nobody, we have none of the mainstream media reporting it. Then what would your message be to Kurdish solidarity networks, perhaps in Europe and in America and all over the world, and indeed Kurds in the diaspora and to Kurds in the KRG? How do we raise our voices? What is your message to friends of Kurds all around the world? You know, you see the absolute disaster that will unfold if the KDP and the PKK take up arms against each other. It's going to be another Kurdish civil war. And as you said, you know, Turkey, you know, are going to be walking, they're going to be trying to reclaim their rights of Kirkuk and Mosul, you know, by the anniversary of the Lausanne Treaty in 2023, which is what I think they're trying to do. They're trying to take, you know, they're trying to reclaim Laos, they're trying to reclaim Kirkuk and Mosul Vilayets that they were unhappy that they lost in the Lausanne Treaty. But, you know, so what is your message to Kurds in South Kurdistan, to Kurds around the world? You know, how can we all, as friends of Kurds, what can we do to raise your voice and to be in solidarity with the Kurds?
Getting the message out there about what's happening is the first thing. Just we clearly the corporate media is going to be complicit in our government's silence on the crimes that Turkey is committing. So we have to fill that space. We have to raise our voices. We have to demonstrate. We have to make people aware that that just because it's on the news doesn't mean this is not a seriously important and worryingly worryingly important event on a global political stage. And to Kurds everywhere, like, stand with each other, stay together, do not make divisions. Like KDP, PKK, PUK, like Turkey, Iran, Iraq, Syria, diaspora, doesn't matter. Like, in the long term, what's playing out right now in Bashur is only going to negatively affect Kurds everywhere, because as you just said, Mark, clearly Turkey's dreams are to establish its territory all the way down to Mosul and Kirkuk. And that is not going to be good news for Bashur. And it's not going to be good news for Kurds anyway if, like, Turkey has more power than it already does. So by far the most important thing is that we all band together against this invader right now. And that includes non-Kurdish Iraqis and the Syrians, the Iranians. Like, it's not in anybody's interests except the Turkish government for this expansion to be continuing. And one thing I would just like to add on what people can do, I think there've been some inspirational examples from the UK in recent months. With Palestine and what's been happening there with the Israeli attacks on Palestine, this is something that did break the media wall, at least, and managed to garner a lot of attention recently. And that's led to some really inspiring actions in the UK, for example, you know, people tracking down the supply chains of who is actually selling weapons to Israel, that is committing these crimes. And actually, there are a lot of companies in the UK with a lot of manufacturing of very specialist parts and elements of weapon systems. And people were able to make these connections and then to go to the factories and go to points along the supply chain in the UK and actually shut down these factories physically with their bodies, climbing on the roofs or getting into factories, hitting the emergency stop, getting in the way, locking onto things, blockading, at the very least demonstrating. And this is really important to show that, like, when our governments are not standing up for basic human rights, then we have responsibility as citizens to do something about this. And with Turkey, it's exactly the same. Turkey is one of the biggest customers of the UK arms industry. People really need to start making this connection.
I absolutely agree with you. We must not give up. You know? We must not allow our governments, allow NATO, allow international balance to bring on all this. we as civil society, we have a responsibility to strike back. It's not all in the hands of our governments. There is a lot we can do, starting from spreading the news, educating ourselves, reading about this matter, coming to see, supporting Kurds, supporting delegations like ours, even like allowing us to do this interview, for example, is a great way of sharing what's happening here right now. We are trying to spread the news as much as possible, but unfortunately, the main media stations are absolutely ignoring us in all the possible ways. We have tried them all. So this interview, for example, is a great way of helping in this context. We must share. People have to know. People have to react.
And from what we've seen so far, like in our own humble way, I think we have been pushing the agenda a bit, like the conversation, the discussion publicly in Kurdistan is shifting, and people are aware of our delegation and are talking about the fact that internationals care enough to come here and to talk about this. So absolutely, we need people all over the world to continue this work from wherever you are. You know, write to your MPs, to your politicians, like you know, write to your journalists, and get them to pay attention and get them to pressure them to really take this issue seriously.
Governments must know that their choices do not represent our will. And this is the same Europe, in the States, and especially here in Bashur. These governments and their politics do not represent this, and civil society must strike back.
Des, do you have any other questions?
Well, just really thank you very much.
Yeah, honestly. Yeah.
Your time. You. We hope you all can continue fruitfully on the delegation despite all the obstacles. And we look forward to the final report and perhaps follow-on interview after the delegation, which I think would be something our listeners would really appreciate and we would really appreciate. Once again, on behalf of Mark and myself, thank you so much. And Mark,
I just like to say thank you very much. And you're don't underestimate the work that you're doing, because you're inspiring, years old activists. You're inspiring and motivating us to try and do a little bit more. And so, you know, we really take our hats off to you. I know there's just 22 of you left from the original 140, is that right? Yeah.
Yes.
And you're going to continue to stay there, and you're going to continue to do work?
Yes,
absolutely,
we are.
Absolutely. We will continue with other meetings and trying other visits. We will make the best out of the time we have, which is still not much.
We'll do what we can. Yeah. I'd just like to end by saying thank you to all of the Kurds here who've shown us such hospitality and helped us so much to do the work we've been doing here. Yes. I mean, these people are living this oppression, right? And they've been fighting this fight their entire lives, some of them. So just want to end on that note that we're not the heroes here. We're just here to use our position to amplify these voices and to try and make these connections from what the people are fighting against here to the rest of the world.
Exactly. Absolutely amazing. And I'm sure they would want me to thank you on their behalf as well. So take care of yourselves, and thank you so much. And we look forward to hearing from you perhaps in the not too distant future.
For sure. Yeah. I hope
so. Absolutely. Thank you so much, both of you. Good luck with your work. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
We wanted to share that we have three other friends who live in Erbil, whose job it was to pick up some of the other delegates from the airport upon arrival into Erbil. And on the 13th of June, these three friends went to the airport in Erbil to pick people up. And that was the same day that 12 delegates arriving into the airport were deported and sent back to their countries of origin. And the three who I'm talking about, who came to the airport to pick up the delegates, were arrested by the SAE security forces in Erbil airport.
The worst news is that we still haven't heard anything about them. Since the 13th of June, we have no news about them. We haven't heard a thing. We are extremely worried about our friends. We don't know where they are, why have they been arrested, what's happening to them. So we really want to call for people and listeners to spread this news, put pressure. It is absolutely unacceptable for the KRG and, you know, Erbil Airport security to arrest three people and make them disappear as if nothing happened.